When he was 5 years old, Blake Taylor was diagnosed with ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Blake's now a college student, but he says he had some tough moments in both elementary and high school trying to study like the others. See, he's a bright kid, but he remembers one algebra exam where the teacher told the students to show all their work, but then didn't leave the kind of blank space that Blake thought he would need.
You know, I'm looking at the exam sheet, and I'm thinking, okay, I know how to solve this equation, e to the power of 2x equals 4. I'm like, okay, I know how to solve that. And then all of a sudden, I see the space, and I'm like, okay, well, writing the letter E is going to take a quarter of that page. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to skip some steps because if I skip steps, I'll save room. You know, so I basically felt like I have to do a lot of this calculation in my head now because I can't write it all down. And I wasn't able to get all the answers right.
Blake Taylor takes us inside the mind of a kid with ADHD to see both the troubles and the triumphs he faced. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
A growing number of children are being diagnosed with ADHD, but even today, no one seems to know how prevalent it is. The National Institute of Mental Health says maybe 2 million kids in the U.S. have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The Center for Disease Control says there may be twice that number. Even after years of research, doctors aren't sure what causes ADHD or how best it can be treated. Blake Taylor was diagnosed when he was 5. He's joining me today to talk about his experience. Blake's mother, Nadine Taylor Bonds, is also with me. One of the first times they both knew something was up. Blake was only 3. At the time, he was crazy about dinosaurs, and his family was taking him to the Museum of Natural History to see the new T-Rex display.
It was like the big thing. It was sort of like iPods right that are now, you know. It was like, you know, if you know about the T-Rex and you have toys that are made of plastic that look like the T-Rex, then that's sort of the in thing to have, you know. It was a fun thing to talk about. And my mother took me to the museum. I was looking forward to seeing the T-Rex the whole time, and it was my goal to touch the actual bones of the T-Rex.
And what exactly was at the museum? What was the display you were going to see?
You know, the Museum of Natural History. So there was a lot of, huge, you know, there was primitive man, there was displays on that, there was ancient Egypt, a lot of different things. But in the front, they had the T-Rex, the actual bones of the T-Rex, and it was the real bones. They had found, it was like the most complete T-Rex fossilized structure that they had found, and they were displaying it in the museum. So I wanted to touch it.
And even though you were just a little kid, you were determined that you were not only see it, but touch the bones?
Yeah, because, you know, everybody sees it. So I figured I wanted to do something else other than look at it. And also I could tell my friends, hey, you know, I touched the actual bone. You know, I felt something that was, you know, millions of years old.
Had you talked about this with your family on your way to the museum? Had you said, I'm going to touch that thing?
Oh, no, because if I talked about it, then that'd be revealing my plan. It would have been counterintuitive because then they would have tried to stop me.
And as it was, did anybody stand a chance at stopping you? What happened when you actually got there?
Well, when I got there, the alarm went off in about 2 or 3 seconds. And, you know, I was only a brief time, maybe 5 seconds, I was able to touch it. But the security guards saw me running, and I guess they didn't expect me at first to get over the fence and the ropes and sort of, you know, security that was there, but I managed, and then they sort of pulled me out, and I was with my grandfather. You know, he was a little heavy at the time, so he wasn't able to run after me. My mom was pregnant, so I sort of was able to take advantage of that.
It wasn't really a fair race then.
No, it wasn't. I won all the way.
I remember it because I was literally 9 months pregnant at the time, so very pregnant. So that's what slowed me down, because typically I was able to keep up somewhat with Blake. I mean, he was pretty active, but I could keep up with him rather well. And Blake, of course, was able to get through all the legs and go right into the platform. And then as he did that, I guess there were laser beams surrounding the dinosaur, and all the alarms went off, and then the security guards came running.
You know, it wasn't just a boy, you know, really begging his parents to go to a museum to look at the T-Rex. I was begging my parents to go to the museum, and I actually intended to go touch the T-Rex.
And then, of course, what happens is that my poor mom is there, and she's trying to hide her face, my poor dad, and then the security guards are yelling at me that I'm not disciplining my son or holding on to him appropriately, and so there was a bit of a scene.
Did you have any inkling, any idea that young Blake might try and pull a stunt like this at the museum?
No, I did not know that. I did not know that he was going to try to touch the T-Rex. Blake has been known since then. He's set off alarms in a few museums, so I guess I'm getting used to it. But at that particular time, no, this was a total surprise to all of us. I mean, we were in shock.
So I was hyperactive. You know, I wasn't thinking of the consequences of, you know, going and touching the bone. I mean, who knows? Maybe I could have dissolved the bone with my skin oil or something. You know, I wouldn't have thought of anything like
People
that.
People always say, oh, you know, that mother, she can't control her child. The child is out of control. Look at that mother.
Having ADHD is that it's that extra factor of energy, you know, that extra effort that you put into things.
Did you get in trouble for this?
Oh, of course. Of course I did.
How much trouble?
You know, it wasn't – I mean, I was little, so there was – I guess I was grounded. I don't really remember that part.
Right. But did that matter to you?
Not really. It was sort of – The fact that I could say that I touched the T-Rex was all what was important to me. I was willing to accept the consequences.
Blake Taylor says that even before he went to see the doctors, he knew he was different from other kids. It was his mother, Nadine, who decided, time to see the specialists.
I was somewhat aware that there was this condition, and then as I was watching him, I started noticing that he was exhibiting these characteristics. And then when I went to one of my college reunions, my best friend from college, Carrie, took one look at Blake. He was running around Lathrop Durham at Vassar, and she said, he has ADHD. Get him to a specialist. She had done a lot of research about it, and so she said, the sooner you deal with this, the better. And I took her advice, and of course now she's taking a lot of credit for that.
I just remember being told that I have ADHD and, you know, being told that I was taking medication for it and seeing what my dad called the smart doctor. And he'd have me play with certain types of toys, and he'd talk to me about how I was feeling and how I guess he would observe how I would play with the toys and do like simple logical problems, like, you know, put these shapes in order or something, various different things. So one of the things I remember from my childhood with respect to ADHD is going to see the psychiatrist and you know, being tested in this way. And, you know, at that age, it was sort of fun to be able to play with these toys.
Blake Taylor began his medication when he was 5 years old. He started with Ritalin and says even he thought he could notice the difference.
I remember on the days that I wouldn't take the medication, I would be, you know, running around class. I felt distracted a lot, not able to concentrate. And the days that I did, I felt I was able to do, you know, my times table or whatever it was in elementary school. And when my mom told me, oh, you know, it was sugar pills, I knew that that wasn't exactly true. But I knew from an early age that I was taking pills for the ADHD.
And you actually remember it altering your behavior. If you took your medicine, you were going to have this kind of day. If you didn't take your medicine, you'd have something different. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if I felt not able to do, you know, my math times tables in class, then I knew I had not taken my medicine.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The medicine didn't solve Blake Taylor's ADHD. Back when he was 9 or 10 years old, he routinely had trouble with kids in class.
And basically, one of the ways that I also angered people was sort of like taking over their desk with papers. You know, I never cleaned my desk. I would build the garbage disposals, and I'd basically take up like two desks.
What do you mean by I'd build the garbage disposals?
To occupy myself during class, if I was bored, I'd build these structures out of like papers and rulers and tape and stuff. And that would often go onto other people's desks, in addition to the papers that I would spread out.
Right.
So a lot of folks dislike me because of that.
I guess I can imagine someone in fourth grade going, hey, that's my desk. Stop taping your ruler to my desk.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Were there kids who were routinely mean to you because they saw you as different?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't really like a physical bullying that I experienced throughout my childhood. It was more of a verbal sort of thing going on, you know. And, you know, they'd be like, oh, so why are you doing that? Why are you being so weird? You know, that's really stupid, or, you know, stuff like that. I knew that their opinion was negative towards me, and that was something I didn't like. I used to, you know, have ticking when I was, especially in elementary school, you know, I'd like shake my hand or something or twirl around or something. Also, I used to play the class clown, you know, to sort of cover up the tics. I felt that at that time they were laughing at me as opposed to with me. Mm-hmm. So they would sort of make fun of how I was trying to be the class clown or how I was trying to fit in.
How did the teachers manage this? What are your own memories of that, Blake?
One thing I remember is that the teachers would give me an extra desk. They did what they could. You know, they'd let me, if I were feeling a little bit wild or a little bit hyperactive, they let me go and get a drink of water. If I needed more space, they'd give me more space. Or they might give me a table as opposed to a desk to put all my papers in. They'd try to do as many accommodations as they could, but you know, even so, when it came to seating arrangements, a lot of times the like kids would say, oh, I don't want to sit with Blake, you know.
And what would the teacher do then?
I guess the teacher, there's not much, you know, she could do. I mean, she only had so many desks.
Blake Taylor remembers how he lost one young friend, a boy named Aki.
We had been friends since the fourth grade. We hung out a lot. He came to my house. I went to his house. This was in the era of playdates, you know, when
right.
you would call it hanging out playdates. And, you know, we sort of became good friends. And I think I was building gingerbread houses. And there was this other guy who was sitting at the table with us. And so I remember as I was getting, I can't remember what type of candy it was. And I overheard a conversation. He was saying, oh, you know, why do you hang out with him? He's weird or he does this. He spreads papers over everybody's desk. You know, it was sort of that thing. And I think that was the starting point of Aki's, you know, influenced dislike towards me.
You heard this other kid speaking about you this
yeah.
way, right?
And you know, I'm sure that wasn't the only time either. I'm sure it happened several other times as well because Aki had other friends.
And later that year, on the morning of Blake Taylor's 10th birthday, his friend Aki called to say he wouldn't be coming to the party. Blake says that happens when other kids decide you're different. And I'll talk more with him about learning to cope with ADHD in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. If you were to gather together any group of parents of school kids in the U.S. today and start up a conversation about attention deficit disorder, or ADHD, the one with hyperactivity as part of it, you'd likely hear some pretty divergent points of view. There are the parents who live with the disorder in their homes, and there are others who think that it's simply a matter of better discipline or nutrition. Well, my guests today have heard the debate and they lived the story. Blake Taylor was diagnosed with ADHD when he was 5. His mom, Nadine Taylor Bond, says she knew early on that something was up.
I sensed when he was 3 years old that he was extremely hyperactive. And people say to me, well, that's typical of boys. And in fact, I heard that from my family, well, boys will be boys, yeah. and that's how they are, and you just live through it. But even compared to other boys, Blake was very, very hyperactive.
Give me an example, if you can, of how you measure that, where you'd see him being more hyperactive than another guy his age.
I was literally making coffee in the kitchen. My daughter, who was an infant at the time, she had just been born, she was on the kitchen table in the carrier, and I went to just reach for the coffee in the cabinet. So literally, I had turned around for 2 seconds, and Blake already was starting to push his infant sister off the table. I mean, that's how fast he could maneuver. Or if you went to answer the phone, he would be pulling everything out of the linen closet and creating cities all over the house. I'm thinking also at birthday parties. He would be more hyperactive than the other boys. He'd probably be running around a little bit more, climbing a little more with rockets. He was always wanting to shoot off rockets. So it was this constant level of activity. It was very difficult to be home with him because you would literally be going from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. So, for example, he would do some experiment in the kitchen. Then he would move to do Legos or Kinects in the family room and leave them all over there. Then he would go to his room and pull everything out, the dinosaurs out. Then, so basically, it was a succession. I mean, and I was working. So if I stayed home with him, I would be totally exhausted by the end of the day because you're going from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. And part of what, as I think Blake was describing earlier, there is this hyperactivity. And then it's also fueled by this curiosity, almost an insatiable curiosity, which is wonderful, but it's also really exhausting. So what I would do as a result is then take Blake and then his sister when she was around. We'd go off and have day trips because I felt it was easier to put them in the car and go off somewhere than to try to just be around the house with them.
I had to be tied down to eat my meal. You know, it's that distraction that I wanted to go and move and do something else other than eating or watching TV.
So how long would you last in front of the television? For example, like 30 seconds or 5 minutes? What?
It varies. I'd say it could be anywhere between 5 minutes and 20 minutes. As when I was younger, now I can sit and watch a whole program, but especially at that time, it would be a short, with the exception of the Weather Channel, I must say. I always liked the Weather Channel. My sister and I would always have fights of she wanted Barney and I wanted to watch the Weather Channel.
Why did you want to watch the Weather Channel?
Because I was really interested in weather. When we went to Hilton Head Island in South Carolina once, there was a hurricane coming, and I would watch the Weather Channel tracking the hurricane. And I said, oh, we have to evacuate, you know. And sure enough, a few days later, the police came and said, you actually do have to evacuate. So it was an interest to me. It was sort of like a dinosaur's, but it was the weather interest came after the dinosaur interest.
Sounds more like an obsession than an interest, though, to watch it that long.
Well, my interests are obsessions, so.
And Nadine, back to you, if I can. Tell me about the moment when the doctor said, yep, your son has ADHD. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. It was a relief because now I had a name for what this was, and then it was a matter of moving immediately to, all right, what do we do about it? Uh-huh. And that part, we were taught in management school that when you encounter, you know, a challenge or a problem, you then move into problem solving.
When you talk about getting that sense of relief, knowing that there was a name for your son's hyperactivity, though, I mean, how easy was it to make this explanation something that all your friends would accept, your husband would accept, that clearly it was a relief for you? How did other people take the news?
They didn't believe it. Now, again, you're looking at 1994. A lot of people did not yet know about ADHD. It's not like now where you have advertisements about the medications or ADHD camps. Certainly, it was not well known. In our family, no one else really believed that he had ADHD. Everyone felt he was just an active boy and that this is how boys act. And that, in fact, I perhaps was working too many hours and needed to pay more attention to Blake. So that was sort of the family impression. And clearly, you know, my job was such that I had very long hours in the high-tech world and then a lot of traveling, and they felt that this was impacting Blake and that some of these behaviors were coming out of that.
It's pretty powerful stuff for people to say, this is your fault.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And guess what? I hear that from a lot of other mothers from phone calls I'm getting and emails. This seems to still be the case. The mothers tend to be blamed for these behaviors. It's very, very hard on the mothers. In my case, all right, I felt, yes, I was working long hours and needed maybe to curb back on that. But I knew that I was trying to be very balanced with the discipline. I was trying to understand this child. So I had that faith within myself.
When Blake Taylor was 11, the family moved from the East Coast to California. Blake left his network of friends and found that, once again, he had trouble fitting in.
You know, having to go into a whole new social situation at a new middle school, I started off at zero again.
Was that made more difficult for you because you have ADHD?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things with ADHD is that it can be difficult to make friends. A normal person, yes, would have that problem, but I think I had the problem even more so. As I got there the first day, there were two other guys who were seated across from me, and I remember I just started to spread my papers out like as I usually did. And the next day, they didn't sit next to me, and they all sat at a group at a different table. It was like they were purposely trying to avoid me.
And was there a moment when you tried to say, hey, I have ADHD, and it makes me this way, so can you guys be a little bit tolerant of that? Was that even something that you could do?
No, I didn't really want to reveal it because I thought it would have a more negative effect. I thought it would become even worse, so I didn't say anything.
But looking back on it now, Blake, do you think they figured it out anyway?
Oh, I'm sure they figured something was. I mean, I don't know if they knew it was ADHD, but I'm sure they knew something was up, you know.
So what do they do? What category do they put you in? Do they call you a nerd? Is that where you end up?
No, it wasn't a nerd. It was more the weird category.
And did you make friends that first year?
Yeah, I actually did, because I did make some friends with some of the weird kids. So whether or not they had ADHD is something interesting.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When Blake Taylor was still in high school, he wrote a kind of memoir self-help book for other young people like him with ADHD. He tries to explain how he ran into trouble with simple things, something like an algebra exam. In this case, Blake hadn't bothered to tell his teacher that he needed extra blank space or blank paper to scribble out his equations.
I hadn't talked to the teacher, said, you know, I need this time, I need this space. And, you know, it just hadn't happened yet, and I didn't want to go in the middle of class and say, hey, I need this accommodations because I have ADHD. That would have been a bit embarrassing. So basically, the smaller space made me feel a lot more stressed.
When you talk about the smaller space, you mean the space on the exam page?
Yeah, instead of having a larger space to write out my equations and mathematical calculations, I felt more stressed to have to do that in a smaller space because I felt if I had messed up, then I'd have to cross it out and I have to write it in an even smaller space.
Right.
So I think that added to my anxiety level. I had studied for days before that. I knew the material. You know, I'm looking at the exam sheet and I'm thinking, okay, I know how to solve this equation, e to the power of 2x equals 4. I'm like, okay, I know how to solve that. And then all of a sudden I see the space and I'm like, okay, well, writing the letter E is going to take a quarter of that page. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to skip some steps because if I skip steps, I'll save room.
Yeah, but you're supposed to show all your computations, right?
But you're supposed to show all your computations or even steps in between those computations you have to show
right.
That you may think of logically, oh, I have to skip those. So because you have to skip those and not write it down, you may have calculated it incorrectly in your head. Maybe my 4 was big. I used to write big 4s. You know, so I basically felt like I have to do a lot of this calculation in my head now because I can't write it all down. And because I had to do a lot of the calculation in my head and I had studied writing it all down, I wasn't able to get all the answers right. And I didn't even get all the partial credit right because my steps were often wrong.
And what were you getting wrong? Like simple stuff?
Yeah, often simple stuff. You know, positives or negatives, multiplication or division, or whether something is times something or to the power of something, you know, because I'm a visual learner. So if I had been able to write this down, I wouldn't have made these mistakes.
Tell me something else, Blake. When you have that kind of frustration with the first problem in an exam, does it make the second problem worse and then the third problem worse? Does it kind of build up on you like a snowball going downhill?
Oh, absolutely. I think often what I do on tests is I don't do the first problem because it's sort of intimidating for that reason ever since this test. I think if I do a problem, especially if I don't have enough time or enough space, I sort of write it off and I'm not sure if I got it right or wrong, and then I go to the next, and I'm not sure if I got it right or wrong. So each time I have that uncertainty, it builds up. And by the end of the test, I'm like, oh, gosh, I failed this test, you know.
And you're now doing pre-med courses, is that right?
Yeah, in fact, I have an organic chemistry midterm on Wednesday.
Okay, I don't even want to talk about organic chemistry. I respect people who even try that course.
Yeah, but I studied a lot over spring break, so hopefully it will go well.
Do you still worry about your exams?
Yeah, I worry. I you know, ever since I failed these exams, I always worry. But now I don't think I'm as stressed as I used to be because I have these accommodations.
You mean you get to take the exam in circumstances that are more familiar, where you feel like you're a little bit more in control?
Absolutely. Like, I get a separate room, more time, and more space. That's what I need. And if I have that, I'm able to succeed in my exams. In math especially, there were times when I didn't have those accommodations and I got Fs, and then the times I did, I got A pluses.
And what is it that you eventually hope to be?
I hope to be a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. You know, it'll be another, you know, 9 or 10 years, but I'll get there eventually.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready. I think I have the will to do it, so when there's a will, there's a way, you know.
How much is your own incentive to become a neurosurgeon driven by the fact that you've had this puzzle of your own brain that you've lived with all your life?
It's a big incentive because I have this condition, and, you know, in studying my own psychology, I think that sort of drove me to go into the medical field with regards to the brain. The ADHD has sort of given me an idea of what I wanted to do.
And are you frustrated, Blake, by the fact that there are still gaps in the scientific explanation of ADHD?
Yeah, that's unfortunate, but they are making a lot of progress. I heard recently that they found that certain, I can't remember what lobe it was in the brain, is smaller in people who don't have ADHD and larger than those who do, or at least the studies implied that. But on the other hand, there's no diagnostic test. Like, there's no blood test that you can say and say, okay, yes, you have this protein or something for ADHD. That doesn't happen, or at least not yet.
And you find that there are still people who say ADHD, it's not real?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's, for instance, one of my radio interviews that happened, I was basically ambushed. I was told I was going to have an interview in much the way I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
But basically, after he asked me, oh, so where did you get the idea for the book? He said, oh, well, I don't believe in ADHD. He said it outright. I think it's an excuse for bad parenting. I think it's an excuse for all the medical companies to make money. And he had a caller come in. And for the 15-minute radio interview, this guy was on the phone for 10 minutes. So it was basically these two guys against me. And I'm not a doctor or psychiatrist. I don't know about every single research opportunity that's going on. I'm just here to tell my story. So that was exemplary of how people still don't believe in ADHD.
Did you get a chance to get a word in edgewise? Were you able to make your case?
Not really, because they kept talking and talking. I wasn't able to really – I mean, it wasn't an interview, basically. It was basically, let's make this an example of how ADHD doesn't exist.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. For Blake Taylor, that interview was a good example of what it was that prompted him to write about ADHD as a teenager.
My book is, as far as to my knowledge, is the only one written by someone my age who has ADHD. And it's not a psychiatrist or someone in the medical field working for a drug company saying, oh, well, we've done this study and this percent of people have ADHD. I have been diagnosed, and I'm able to say to everybody who doesn't believe, yes, this is my story. It happened to me. It exists. For the first time, the subject of the study is talking about the story as opposed to the one who's doing the study.
And what was it like to put it all down on paper and have people read it?
I actually like telling my story. You know, I like sharing my personal life because it helps other young people and teens. I get messages on Facebook. I just got one today. They're saying, oh, I really enjoyed your book. It really helped me, or it helped my sister. And I just get these messages, and it's like, wow, you know, it's good that I told my story so it helps other people.
As Blake Taylor was telling me, he's now in college. He's still taking his meds. He still has symptoms of ADHD. His mother, Nadine, sees it when he comes home.
His room, it's like a hurricane has hit his room. So evidently here at college, and especially with his roommates, he works on his room and tries to keep it neat. But when he comes home, it's like it always has been. So I'd say that's the first evidence.
The whirlwind hits again, right?
The whirlwind hits, yeah.
And so to what extent does medication have an effect on someone who's, say, in his early 20s and coping with ADHD?
I think the medication has more of an effect allowing me concentrate. I know that if I don't take the medication for a day, I'm not able to do my work as efficiently as I would have. You know, I have that distraction tendency, not being able to sit down for an amount of time. I get bored really quickly because as I go from thing to thing, I eventually run out of things to do and I become bored. Mm-hmm. So I think the medication for me is important.
And just as important now as it would have been when you were 10 years old. Is that reasonable, Blake?
Yeah, it's reasonable. Yeah, and also I think what the medication allows me to channel the energy that I was talking to you about.
Yeah.
I think it provides that pathway. It doesn't channel the energy for you, but it allows me to channel the energy. So I think in my case, it's important to take the medication.
And Nadine, when Blake comes home from college and he's been sitting at the kitchen table for 2 minutes, can you tell if he's on his meds or not?
Well, the Strattera is long acting, so
He can miss it for a day.
Yes, there's evidence. Yeah, there's evidence there. So he, he'll throw things around a little bit. He just returned from Connecticut last night, and his luggage is all over the room, and it looked like it exploded. So you know Blake is home.
and there's no going in there and saying, Blake, tidy this up?
Well, we try. I've been doing that for 18 years now, so.
I escape back to Berkeley before she can.
Blake Taylor is a student at UC Berkeley. His mother, Nadine Taylor Bonds, lives in California as well. And you can find out more about Blake and his book, ADHD and Me. It's all at our website. That's thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Last week, I had a conversation with the newspaper editor, Steve Wright. We talked about what it was like for him to have his son go off to war. See, Steve was and still is opposed to the war in Iraq. And while that didn't change when his son was overseas, Steve found himself determined to show his young soldier as much personal support as he could for the boy's decision to go into the military.
We did not want to sign for him to join early, and we would not let him test out of high school. But right when he turned 18, I was very supportive of going with him to the base where you do the sign up here in California. And it was a surprising experience for me because out of the 30 or 40 young people that were in there waiting to sign up, there was only one or two parents, and I was one of them. Hmm. And then here were these kids making huge decisions for their lives. And I realize not every parent can afford time off or can have flexible time to do that, but that many kids being there with only two parents was surprising.
Michael Philbrick was listening to the radio when Steve was talking, and Michael wrote me a note. He said that he thought it was helpful to see the parent side of things and maybe understand a little better what my parents went through. Michael wrote to say that I was deployed in 2006 with the Marine Corps Reserve. My decision to join the military was a selfish one, as I did not consult them at all in making it. Michael Philbrick's decision to enlist wasn't sudden, though. His attraction to military life began when he was quite young.
I've always been interested in the military, you know, fighter jets and tanks, and I enjoyed, you know, playing with army men and stuff. And I mean, I definitely got the vibe from my mom that she did not like toy guns, things like that. She didn't like it when I played with them. You know, she didn't like me watching war movies. You know, it's one of those feelings, you know your parents, you know what they don't approve of.
Yeah.
Whether it's just, inferring that or they actually tell you. I'm sure that was a combination of things.
You would have been entering college just about the time of 9/11.
I was in college during 9/11.
So what was the point in college, Mike, when you seriously started to think about signing up?
Probably junior year. I mean, we had Marine Corps officer recruiters come, and they set up a table in the student center, outside the cafeteria. And with my interest in the military, I sort of am like, ooh, there's a Marine. I'm gonna go talk and learn more. And the recruiters, they facilitate it. They make it easy for you to believe that you can do it. And I mean, I did it, obviously.
And did they seem interested in you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they're always interested, to see what your potential is.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was sort of part of my plan. I didn't know what I wanted to do after college. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll do a few years in the Marine Corps as an officer. That would be a great background. You know, I can figure out what I want to do. Maybe I'd want to do it as a career.
Did you talk to your folks about this?
I don't think so. Not really. And I definitely, you know, think there have been instances in my life where I haven't talked to them about things because I was afraid of their reaction.
Yeah.
And this was one of them. If they asked me, you know, I'd mention, oh, well, maybe the military, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, it sort of wouldn't go much further than that.
Lance Corporal Mike Philbrick enlisted with the Marine Corps Reserve in 2004 during his senior year in college. It was only after graduation that he finally told his parents.
I think I told my dad first. My dad's, you know, he's sort of the quiet, like, intelligent type. Doesn't say anything unless he has something to say.
So what did he have to say?
The thing is, like, he doesn't say much. You know, he doesn't say much. And, you know, he's always been, when he does say something, it's potent. It's important. And, you know, he's always let me know that he's, you know, he's proud of what I've accomplished, and so is my mother. But I'm used to her, you know, sharing her emotions and her feelings.
Well, we'll get to your mom in just a minute. Was your father giving you, like, any indication that he thought this was a good idea or a bad idea, or that he was going to leave it up to your mother to talk to you what was going on?
I don't get that impression. I mean, I have a solid impression from my mom. I don't, you know, I don't recall that from my father. It's more like he just sort of takes it in stride, thinks about it, and he gives his vote of support, and then you sort of, you know, that's the reaction you get.
Let's switch to your mom. What did she say?
There's one thing that stuck with me, and you know, that was, you know, I think it was, you know, a very raw emotional statement that any parent would probably is probably thinking when they hear, oh, you're joining the military. And that was that she, you know, she told me that she didn't raise me to die. And that was, you know, that's one of those things that just sort of, you know, hits you right in the heart. That definitely cut to me, and it's like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this to her. I feel like, you know, I don't know, I just felt bad, like I was doing something, you know, sort of like I was doing something wrong, and that I should be, you know, caring for my mother and taking care of her and not doing something that's going to hurt her. And that's the first thing I'd really done in life, I think, that hurt her. You know, not sharing that decision with her, which eventually led to her, you know, fearing that she was going to lose me. And like Mr. Wright said, you know, no parent wants to outlive their children.
Yeah. Was it enough, Mike, to make you have a second thought about joining the reserves, to say, I knew she'd have this reaction. I'll get an office job.
I never considered, like, you know, trying to get out or running away from it. You know, it's one of those things like, oh, I hate that I'm doing this to her, but I can't change it. I'm not going to change it because, you know, this is, regardless of how I affected her, it was still something I wanted to do, and it's something to this day I don't regret.
So from the time that you signed up, from the time that you told your mother over the phone that you were in the Marine Reserves and that you were mm-hmm. going to Iraq, was there any moment when the two of you got together and kind of squared this away and said, okay, look, I'm sorry I didn't tell you earlier, but I'll, you know, take good care of myself. And, you know, was there any kind of patching that up?
I mean, I don't recall there being any, like, you know, major rift between us after the fact. Sort of, she took it, she accepted it. And I don't think me joining was that as big of a deal as me going to Iraq was.
Were they around when you left?
Yeah, I mean, the last time I saw them was, my unit was in California at 29 Palms. There's a Marine Corps base out there. We had a break at some point, some leave, like a week maybe, a few days before we were set to ship out. And, you know, they flew out to Denver. My parents flew out to Denver. My girlfriend did as well. And then I flew from California there, and you know, we spent a few days. And it wasn't like it was, you know, the last time I was going to be seeing them. It was just like, oh, a fun trip, you know, like a fun weekend. It wasn't heavy or, you know, a big elephant in the room or something like that.
It's generally a pretty tough moment for parents,
right?
You know, when they're sending a son off to Iraq.
That's what listening to Mr. Wright, that was helpful for me to understand. You know, help me understand what my parents went through.
Because they weren't saying to you what Steve Wright was saying.
No, I mean, my family, my mother likes to make fun of my father's side and that we don't talk about things. And my grandmother made some comment that if we didn't have a dog, that our family would never talk. I don't think that's the case anymore. It hasn't been for a long time, you know, since I sort of have matured into an adult. But I don't think I really got their exact impressions. Or, I mean, maybe it's just one of those things where, like, I'm so used to them that maybe I tuned them out or I don't remember it as well as when I heard somebody, you know, a complete stranger, talking about their experience. And that helps me understand my parents better, not hearing what they have to say.
Mike Philbrick enlisted in the Marine Corps Reserve when he was in college, but didn't tell his parents about his decision until afterwards. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. In 2006, Mike was deployed to Iraq, to Fallujah. He recalls one incident when he and his unit took over a house. That house had an open roof, and they would take turns keeping lookout from it. As Mike explains, it was a potentially lethal place to be.
You know, at one point I was on the roof doing my shift, and in the insurgency there, they had this thing they would do with mortars, where they'd have a vehicle, they'd drive out a ways away, they'd figure out where we were. They'd set the mortar tube up, and you'd hear off in the distance here these like three pops, and you'd be like, wait, what was that? And then, a round would hit. And in this situation, like the round hit, maybe 75 yards away from the house we were in, and then the next one was even closer, maybe half that distance. And then I was sitting on the roof, completely exposed, and all you can do is sit there. I mean, we got mortared before. That you're used to that sort of feeling of helplessness. But I was able to vividly tell that these rounds were coming, walking closer to the building we were in, and I'm sitting up there on top of it, and the last round ended up hitting the house right next to us,
and exploding.
Yeah, all three of them detonated.
Yeah.
And, I felt pretty fortunate after that, but it was a different feeling. Like, we've been shot at, and you can shoot back, and that's easy to deal with relative to just sort of sitting there, on top of a roof, hunkered down against the wall that's not going to do much for you, and waiting to see what happens. And that's no fun.
Did you ever tell your parents that story?
I definitely, they told us not to, we were able to communicate pretty well. We used letters. We had a satellite phone we could use for a few minutes each day. But they told us not to share things like that. And I wouldn't in any way, even if it was allowed, because it's not, my mother, was worried enough. My parents were worried enough. All my friends and family, they're all worried enough about me. The last thing they needed to know is hear every detail about the danger that I'm in. So I never shared that with them while I was there. I think I might have mentioned it once I got back.
Probably not in that amount of detail.
Right. Right. It's one of those things where, I knew how she would react, and I didn't. I'm always referring to my mother in most of these situations because, she's the one who communicates and lets me know how she's feeling. So,
while you were in Iraq, did you have any idea how they were coping with, waiting and wondering about news concerning you?
I don't know. I think you're pretty... You're pretty focused in your world over there.
Yeah,
I'm sure I thought about it, but it's hard to. It's hard not to be sort of selfish at that point. I knew that my parents and my family members and people were worried about me, but I don't recall how much I really thought about. I thought about it. You're very focused on what's going on where you are. And
how long were you in Iraq, Mike?
7 months.
And what was it like coming home when you got back home to Charlottesville?
It was great. We came back to Maine, and my girlfriend met me there, and we drove. We got off the bus, and I got in got in the car, and we drove straight through to Virginia. And we got home, and I walked in the front door, and my parents came from wherever they were in the house, and my mother was crying, and maybe my dad was too. I'm not sure. It doesn't really show much of it, but maybe some red eyes, and hugs and stuff all around, and they'd had a lot of information, so it wasn't like, I had to tell them all that had gone on.
Yeah.
But, it was just catching up and being close to each other.
I'm wondering about that time when you came back, if you noticed anything changed between you and your parents.
They're incredibly relieved.
Yeah.
And to this day, she says, I don't want you to have to go over there again. I hope you don't have to go over there again. You're not going over there again, right?
But after you had a chance to listen to this fellow that we had on the program, Steve Wright, talking about all that was going through his mind as a parent while his son was serving in Iraq, I wonder if it got you thinking, we should talk about that. I wonder what was going on in my parents' mind. Did you ever go back and explore that?
Well, yeah, I'd mentioned that, I was going to be speaking with you and
right.
How I'd heard this interview. I told her that I might be speaking with you about how this story, Steve Wright's story, had made me think about what they had gone through. And so she sent me this email back.
You don't happen to have it with you there, do you?
I do.
Can you read it?
I do. Let's see. She says that this did take me back to thinking about my experience with your enlistment. At least then I could pretend you would not get deployed. And when you actually were called up, Dad telling me as we were walking the path next to the river up to the art museum in Philly on a fall Saturday afternoon, walking around with my cell phone for 10 months and loving seeing that 808 area code from Iraq coming in on my caller ID. We were and are proud of you, but it was stressful and scary. Which, you know, all of this is more insight probably than I've had. Just because of, you know, this story I heard.
What's it like to get those little snippets of your mother's insight, even a year and a half after you were serving in Iraq?
It's great. I mean, that was what I got from Mr. Wright's interview, and this is very specific, and this is, you know, I have images of my time in Iraq in my head, you know, all the time, but now I can sort of, you know, what was going on, you know, back at home and understand what they went through. Because even though she didn't say a lot of stuff there, the fact that she would have never let her cell phone out of her sight, you know, for 10 months. And, I mean, you know, my dad picked sort of such a peaceful place to tell her about me being deployed. I don't know. It just gives a lot of insight into their relationship with each other and some insight into how important I am to her. All that she went through, and you know, is still, you know, still talking to me.
Yeah, mothers are good that way.
Yeah, it's nice that way. It's, you know, it's too easy to take them for granted, and that was something that I learned from this, was that things you do, just because it's your life, you know, the things you do affect those who care about you, and if you care about them back, then you should think about that. And I wish that I had realize exactly what I was going to do. Maybe I did realize it, and I tried to avoid it by not confronting it and sort of avoiding telling my parents that I was enlisting. And if I could go back, I think I would have, you know, I would speak to them about it ahead of time. And I speak to them about a lot of things these days.
Mike, I appreciate your time.
I appreciate yours. Thank you for having me.
Lance Corporal Michael Philbrick is now a recruiter himself for Norwich University. It's a military college in Vermont. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Last week on The Story, we marked the anniversary of the shootings at Virginia Tech in a conversation I had with Professor David McGrath. David's a 58-year-old English professor at the University of South Alabama, and he'd written a public proposal suggesting that professors, like him, could carry guns in the classroom.
Well, my proposal was simply to allow professors who are willing, who are volunteers, who would like to go through screening and training to be armed to protect their students.
And if they changed the rules, or if they allowed professors to carry a weapon, would you carry one?
I would to keep my students safer. I feel a responsibility towards my students to do that for them. In fact, Dick, I had asked my students at USA if they would feel safer, if their parents would feel safer, if the law were changed so that I could carry a weapon in class while I was teaching. And they said yes, for the most part, but they said it would be better if they were allowed to carry weapons. I have a number of students who apparently have conceal and carry permits. One of them pointed out to me that, well, Professor McGrath, I think we would feel safer and our parents would feel a little better if you were armed and someone came through that door carrying a weapon. But you're a little old, Professor McGrath, and your reactions are a little slow and your vision might not be as good as mine.
After my conversation with David McGrath, I got a number of letters from you. Bob works at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and he wrote to say, I was simply infuriated with his arrogance that he can simply strap on a gun and everyone is safe. Does he think I can pick up a herringbone jacket and a piece of chalk and teach poetry? I'd be more concerned that he would cause more of a problem by injuring himself or nearby students than any deranged gunman. If he's interested in safety on campus, why not advocate to allow those with real training to carry those weapons? Most campuses have a large number of military and law enforcement veterans. I know of at least three in my building here on the campus of the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. And Kevin wrote in to say that in Michigan, the required level of training is 8 hours of range time, firing a minimum of 30 rounds. But this would not prepare anyone for a conflict situation in a crowded room unless teachers are willing to undergo the same level of firearm situation training that police are subject to. They should not be carrying guns. Kevin also noted what some other listeners pointed out when he added that also the shooters almost always kill themselves when they're finished, and this leads me to believe that the potential of being shot at will not be a deterrent. If you have any thoughts or ideas about stories that you're hearing here on the program and you'd like to send me a note, we're wide open and welcome to that kind of feedback. You can get to me most efficiently through our website at thestory.org. You can call and leave a message on our phone, 1-888-966-9862, or write a letter to The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.